bankruptcy, along with a proper negotiation process with a leader who will stand up and fight for taxpayers, will result in both the school staying open, no layoffs. I don't think that we should have to lay off a teacher if this is structured properly. We can protect our children and their education and still protect taxpayers.
Once again, in the state of Illinois, in the city of Chicago, it's all about the kids. It's not about the grown-ups. It's all about the kids. Rick Pearson here, finest political writer in America. Chicago Tribune, ChicagoTribune.com, host of the Sunday Spin. Who's a guest this week?
I've got David Yepsen from the Paul Simon Institute.
Big help to us out in Iowa.
Guy knows everything about the Iowa caucuses. And former Iowa Republican Chairman Matt Strawn as we recap Iowa and look ahead to New Hampshire.
Well, they were both very good to us in our couple of shows up there. All right, let's go over some basics here. Didn't we just have a strike? And why are the teachers in the all wound up in the unions all wound up in this again?
Well, we had a strike in 2012,
right?
But now new contract talks.
So it was a 3-year deal that's expiring.
It's expiring, and you know, one of the interesting
4 years or whatever.
One of the interesting things in this is that you did have the Chicago Public Schools, Forrest Claypool, and Karen Lewis, Chicago Teachers Union, had a tentative deal, and the alleged deal was taken back to the House of Delegates by the Teachers Union and summarily rejected. This raises the question about, you know, a lot of people are critical of Karen Lewis, think she's kind of too far out there, but here she was negotiating a deal, and that was rejected by her membership. So what legitimacy is there with Karen Lewis and her members as far as, you know, moving forward the union? This is a very concerning issue, particularly when you look at the financial issues that are facing the Chicago Public Schools.
All right, we fast forward to yesterday, and there was a big press opportunity and a big headline-grabbing move to close down a $750,000 account at Bank of America. What was that money for?
Well, that's investment money by the teachers' union. They're complaining about a lot of the financial moves that CPS has taken through the administration have resulted in overtly expensive loan deals that make the banks profit at the expense of money that should be going into the school system. So, yeah, it would show, you know, very much a prop kind of thing. But the bottom line remains, there is no deal here for the teachers and CPS. They are talking about filing an unfair labor practice because CPS plans to impose things like in 30 days that the portion of teacher pensions that public schools pick up for them in lieu of a pay increase, that's going away.
So wouldn't it behoove the union to make a deal?
Well,
because you don't have to get to that deadline. You don't have, of course, we will, but you don't have to get to that point. So what is the city or, I know, and I'll ask Forrest Claypool this when he's on in a few minutes, but what does the city say they're offering and what do the teachers want?
Well, one of the things that had been on the table was, yes, this pension pickup is going to go away, that teachers would contribute more towards their pensions than they do now. Mm-hmm. But there would not ostensibly be a pay raise for the duration of the contract, or very few teachers would get a raise. In essence, they would be taking a pay cut because they're giving more money into their pensions. I mean, pay now, pay later kind of thing. But then also part of the provisions of this was that there would be teacher layoffs. And those kind of factors were the two major factors in the rejection of this proposed contract.
Haven't the teachers kind of backed themselves into a corner now, though, Rick, because they said no to what they were offering? Now Rauner's saying, well, you got to file for bankruptcy if you want to get anything from the state. They're not going to give them any money.
Well, Rauner's, quite frankly, when it comes to this, Rauner is playing an outside game right now because he talked about, well, you know, I'm going to have my people look at financial oversight of the schools. I'm looking at picking an interim superintendent so when the state takes over. None of that can happen without legislation. Legislation's not going anywhere.
Because you need Democrats to pass it, and they're
exactly
not going to do that.
And they're not going to do that. So, I mean, one of the interesting things is yesterday CPS sold $725 million in bonds. huge penalty on the interest rate because they're in junk bond status.
8.5%, 8.75%.
And 8.75%. City Hall's response to that is they're saying that the CPS got charged the Rauner penalty. And, and here's more of the rhetoric, but alleging that Rauner, with talking about bankruptcy, talking about those kinds of issues, insolvency, basically created a penalty that bond buyers found to jack up the interest rate.
And they have to
pay that
penalty.
How it works. That's not how penalties work. Penalties work because you've accrued bad credit status.
Well, and indeed, that was the whole issue, is that they are in junk bond status.
Right, in junk bond status.
You pay Rauner, the penalty and the interest.
Yeah, Rauner picked up on junk bond status. That was left for him by the three or four or five or seven previous governors.
Oh, well,
this
isn't the state's junk bond status. This is Chicago Public Schools.
Right, but my point is you can hit Rauner with a lot of things very legitimately. This ain't one of them.
No, but certainly there's a question about when he has spoken in the past very stridently towards the issue of the Chicago Public Schools and bankruptcy. It's at times when CPS is looking to go sell bonds.
But isn't this where we've run into and banged our head against the walls before? I saw the poll in the Tribune this morning that says 3/4 of the people are backing the teachers. Only 25% see the city side of this argument. Those people that were polled are in large part not basing that on facts, in my opinion. They're basing it on the fact that they really don't like ROM. And I suppose there's not a way you can quantify that.
Well, actually, in our previous polling, when we've asked, and every time we've done a city poll, it's we've all asked this question.
And what's the trend?
And this is the absolute trend. Even when ROM does have a good job approval ratings, it's still people side with the teachers.
And there's this opinion that the city's out to get the teachers.
Well, and I don't know if it's that as much as. One, this is still very much a union-rooted city. And so there is, we ask whether you support, do you side with ROM, do you side with Chicago Teachers Union? And I think one is, there's still a lot of union roots in this city. Two, there's still great affection by people for teachers.
Same here.
And then you couple that, yes, the ROM factor, you know. Here's the teacher, apple on the desk, and then there's ROM, who's got the knife ready to cut the apple. You know,
right.
But isn't there a similarity between the state pension mess and the city schools mess in that it all comes down to the same thing? Regardless of how we got here, we got this much money, and we got this much to pay in bills. Something's got to give. So, I don't want a single teacher to take a pay cut. But something's got to give.
Right. Well, but one difference, and truly part of the problems, the financial problems of the Chicago Public Schools are with the pensions. I mean, back in 95, when then-Mayor Daley was given control of the school, something he wanted, the CPS also got pension holidays where they didn't have to pay money into the teacher pension fund.
I don't see why paying a little more into your pension is a bad thing.
And will they grandfather the folks, the older teachers, where theirs wouldn't be affected, but it would be a new teacher thing? Or is that just still, it'd be across the board?
It'd be across the board.
Okay. Look, pay me now or pay me later is a phrase that you said. We've said it here many times. I don't know in what world any of the unions are living where they think suddenly Illinois is going to become solvent by not getting anywhere with any of this stuff. Are you legally entitled to your contract? You absolutely are. But if your contract can't be paid, it can't be paid. So save as much money as you possibly can and strike a deal before that pile of money gets even smaller.
Well, and as we've said before, and particularly about pensions, because of the way they're constitutionally protected, there's no give. We have to pay. That's the way the law is. You can change the Constitution. You can do whatever you want. But there is no give by the unions on pensions.
Right. But
But look at the fact, though, that those pensions are eating up 25%,
close to
25% of the state budget.
If we stay with the broken rules that have gotten us into this position, we will be Detroit. We'll be Detroit in about 15 minutes. So unless we get people together to go, we got a huge problem here. We got to work together to solve it. That's not Steve's idealistic world. That's just facts. Unless people get together to do that, We are headed right where Detroit was, by the way, because Detroit's coming back. So we'll be the new Detroit in downtown Chicago. In the city, in all the surrounding suburban districts, everybody thinks everything's going great. It's coming to your door, people. I say it every day. It's coming to your door because those that you elected can't figure out a way to get around it. And we got a line of lawyers who can't wait to take it back to court. You talk about a self-fulfilling prophecy. We're too stupid to not see it.
And the trouble is, cutting a deal of any kind in an election year is virtually impossible.
Right, which again, how far up your butt you have to have your heads to not see the outcome here. Can you hear the echo, Springfield? That's you. Coming up on 7 o'clock, more to come on 720 WGN. In the morning, Forrest Claypool is in charge of Chicago schools, and he has a giant bottle of Advil on his desk, which he refills every 20 minutes. Good morning, Mr. Claypool. How are you?
Good morning, Steve. How are you?
I'm all right. I don't envy your position, and I certainly pull for teachers as well. And so let's start there. Are you in the city trying to knock all teachers out of work and put them into one giant home where they'll have to support each other?
Well, I'll tell you what, we all know, look, we all know that the teachers and our principals are the, you know, the key to the success. In fact, we got to really laud our teachers because in the last 4 years, we've seen enormous progress for our kids. I mean, despite all these financial problems, Chicago Public School students are doing better than ever. Record graduation rates, test scores, going to college more than ever. A lot of academic growth that exceeds state and federal growth. So a lot good going on with them, and obviously we want to keep our teachers teaching, and we want to support them and give them the resources that they need, which is why which is why we have to get through this crisis. We have to balance the budget, and everybody's got to be part of that solution.
What's the union asking for that the city is unable to deliver? Is it strictly cash, or is it cash and prizes?
Well, you know, the big bargaining committee that rejected the tentative agreement we had with CTU leadership really didn't critique the contract as the specifics. Really what they talked about was that they didn't trust our ability to carry through on the promises in the contract. And so they said it was a question of trust. So we hear that, and we're anxious to get back to the bargaining table with them to try to address those issues. If there's language or guarantees or other things we can do to strengthen the things they like in the contract but simply don't believe that can be delivered, then we want to address that.
But just help me out with that for a second. If the union agreed to a tentative deal and there's a trust issue on the union side, isn't it the union leadership's job to convince the rank and file that the trust issue can be, you know, put aside because they agreed to the deal? What am I missing there?
Yeah, it's confusing. The CTU has a very democratic process. They have a multi-tiered step of approvals that goes from the leadership to a 40-member big bargaining committee to the House of Delegates to the rank and file. So we were at stage two, and that's where it got hung up. So I'm not really an expert in internal CTU politics, but it's more difficult than in working out deals with other unions, that's for sure.
Forrest, what's your response to Karen Lewis's response, where she's calling the proposed cuts an act of war?
Well, we're not at war. We're at the bargaining table, and we will be again on Friday. And the fact that we spent 18 consecutive days from early to late working out a deal, I think, is a sign that we can get there, and we can get a deal, and we're both committed to a deal. You know, the steps that we took earlier this week were not steps that we took lightly. No one wants to cut staff in schools, and these are things that, unfortunately, when you have a $1.1 billion budget deficit, at $500,000 hole in our budget this year alone, that crisis threatens our schools. It means that we can't keep our doors open if this continues much longer. We simply ran out of time to start whacking that deficit down so that we're not borrowing millions of dollars every day that ultimately will be at the expense of our kids in our classrooms and threaten our ability to keep the school doors open.
Is it true that most of the cuts fall on special ed education? And if so, why does it fall that way?
Not at all, and not one cent.
So, well, you've seen the story, you know, so where does that
what
come
story?
From?
What story?
Just a story that special education is getting whacked harder than other parts of the schools.
Oh, that's completely false. We're spending more money on special education this year than we did last year, and none of these cuts will be in special education.
So that's a bad leak or faulty reporting in some form?
Correct.
Okay. Well, I appreciate the clarification on that. So the cuts that you had to take, because, again, there's this much money and there's this much in bills, where do they fall? General population for educators or administrators?
We obviously rely on our principals to make those decisions. They know their schools. They know how they have to deliver the curriculum to their children, and they will obviously make the cuts in a way that mitigates impact on the classroom. And obviously, we've said that we're going to do everything we can working with our principals to avoid teacher layoffs, obviously. So obviously, I think some of the support and administrative staff in the schools will more likely be targeted, but each principal will have to make those decisions.
Is there a formula that is far – listen, I'm not expecting you to explain it here, but how do you tell the principals how much they need to cut per school? It depends on the size of the school, that type of thing?
Well, it's really a proportional amount of the budgets. We will be giving them their numbers on Monday, but what we're talking about is a $100 million cut, so we're really talking about roughly 5%, but each school and each principal will make those decisions, and we have support and other things we can do to help mitigate in addition to make sure we get through this school year in a way that doesn't impact our kids.
Come with me into the land of make-believe for a second, and let's pretend that the state's going to get a budget together in the next 30 days. What difference would that make for you?
Would make a huge difference if the issue of education funding is addressed. As we've begun to point out, and people are just now beginning to realize, we have an education system in Illinois that is separate but unequal, where kids in the rest of the state get a certain amount of money for their educations, and kids in Chicago, 86% of whom are low income, receive far less. We receive 27% less education funding in Chicago than schools in the rest of the state receive on average, and that is a system that by any standard cannot withstand scrutiny. So you'll be hearing a lot more about that in the coming weeks and months, and I believe ultimately that the state will have to change that system one way or the other, and just equality. I mean, our kids are 20% of state enrollment, our taxpayers pay 20% of state income taxes, but we receive less than 15% of state education funding, and just equality alone would be $500 million a year extra to Chicago Public Schools.
Forrest, how soon could we see layoffs, teacher layoffs?
That's the process that's beginning, and the teachers will get their numbers on Monday. We're hopeful that there won't be teacher layoffs. We're going to do everything we can to prevent that. But obviously there will be layoffs, and it's just a question of how fast the principals can put their budgets together.
Forrest, it's Rick Pearson from the Tribune.
Hi, Rick.
I know we've talked about this whole issue of funding schools by zip code and the nature of that, but we've talked about that for decades and decades. And yes, while people are talking about the need to do a new school aid formula, even the governor, when you look at the dysfunction that exists in Springfield, you had the governor the other day say he wants a new school aid formula, but he doesn't want any schools to lose money they already have. That's going to take a massive influx of cash. Given the political realities and how we've had this debate over decades, how confident are you that any changes are actually going to happen?
Well, even the governor has said there has to be more revenue. The one thing that the leaders down there and the governor agree on is that ultimately there has to be more revenue, and I think most people want that to go to education. But as you know, Rick, as you're covering it every day in this marathon down there, the governor has another agenda which he wants addressed before we get to that. And that's fine if he wants to hold up the state budget, but he shouldn't hold the children of Chicago hostage to that political agenda.
Do you think there needs to be more equitable funding around the state for all schools? I mean, one of the things that's come out recently is we think of the poorest schools being strictly in the city of Chicago, but there's districts in suburban areas that are extremely underfunded and in rough shape as well.
Well, there's no question. I think, first of all, I think we recognize that Illinois does so little compared to other states for education, almost dead last in the percentage of education funding that comes from the state. When it comes to recognizing the higher cost of educating kids in poverty, we're 50th out of 50. So there's a lot that's needed. And, yeah, there are all kinds of schools across the state that would benefit by a changed formula. And there's a lot of talk and momentum around that. I mean, there are downstate communities, suburban communities, city of Chicago that would all benefit not just from higher education funding, but a system that takes into account the different variances between districts that create massive inequalities.
It's Forrest Claypool, head of the CPS schools. Good luck in the negotiations. I hope you're back at the table soon, and I don't mean to have lunch.
It'll be Friday, so thank you. Appreciate it.
All right, thanks for being on. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
All right, Forrest Claypool, the head of the CPS schools. We'll come back and get traffic here. 7:26. Pat Brady is from Next Generation Strategies and joins us now on the phone. Good morning, Mr. Brady.
Morning.
How are you?
Living the dream, buddy.
All right, then. Eric Edelstein, what is your company?
Our company is AL Media Strategy.
At Adel64, at Pat_Brady. Rick Pearson is here as well from the Chicago Tribune. I assume you guys just heard the comments of Forrest Claypool. Either one of you, thoughts on the school situation? All right, your time's up. Rick, your thoughts? No, either one of you.
Those crickets sound like the bond buyers.
You know? Say again?
No. I say that Forrest is doing a great job. And I think, you know, look, it's a negotiation. You're going to have a lot of public posturing, a lot of stuff said in the press, and then you get serious at the bargaining table. I think given how little help they're getting from Springfield, how dire the financial situation is, I think it's impressive they've come this far. And I think there's a better chance than not that they will reach an agreement sooner than later.
Yeah, I agree, and I hope so. But the bottom line is they're going to try to ask for $500 million from Springfield. And before they do that, things need to change. We can't just keep having these crisis moments and asking the taxpayers for more money. And I applaud the governor for actually getting involved and saying, for the first time, the taxpayers are going to have a voice in this.
Is there going to be someone whose butt the monkeys are going to have to fly out of before this deal's done, Rick Pearson?
Well, you know, the fact that maybe there is more pressure on cutting a deal, but we thought we had a deal. And again, that goes back to, I think, what should be very concerning to folks is the fact that, you know, at a bargaining table, you assume when you've struck a tentative deal that it's going to get ratified by the union membership.
Well, and the process of ratifying the agreement, the four stages of no, I mean, I don't know how they've gotten anything done.
Well, as Forrest said diplomatically, it's a very democratic process.
Why is everything in Illinois like a Rubik's Cube? Why isn't something an up or down vote and it actually sticks?
Well, but truly, for a union contract, the union members are entitled to have their say.
Well, no, I understand that, but I've never heard of a union situation, and maybe there's a lot of them. And again, keep in mind I'm a union member, but I've never heard of a union situation where four different groups have to say, uh-huh, before you actually get the go-ahead, after an agreement's been reached.
And, yes, is that cumbersome? Yes. Is there bureaucracy? It is. Yes. It's that's also part of how government works or doesn't work.
A concern about the kids. I'm also concerned about teachers because, obviously, the vast majority of teachers aren't involved in the negotiation. They trust people to negotiate for them. And I don't know, fellas, I just don't think the teachers are getting a fair shake out of this either.
Well, there's no question, and it doesn't help when, as Karen Lewis said, the rantings of a madman in Springfield and the governor says things that make no sense and tries to inject himself into the process. You know, the guy spent, Governor Rauner has spent the last few years really tearing down teachers, and I think that demoralizes the profession and doesn't help you get to yes. So I agree with you, Steve. I think it's the school kids and the teachers, frankly, who are the ones that drive this stuff. You know, the other part on the money, I've said this before, and I think Forrest has done this. The Chicago public schools or Chicago public taxpayers give more money to Springfield than the kids get back in money. So this notion somehow that Chicago, you know, bleeds money from Springfield, it's just not the case.
Well, the reality is they're going to go back to taxpayers now and ask for another $500 million because of their ineptitude in managing the finances of Chicago public schools and people who live in the suburbs, who the Democrats like to stick it to. You know, we're all going to get hit again. And I live out in the suburbs. I pay a ton in property tax for good schools. And now we're going to have to support the Chicago public schools because they haven't been able to manage themselves. It'd be great in this debate at some point if Karen Lewis wasn't the most prominent figure in the city of Chicago. We actually started having discussions about school teachers and children and how they're getting educated versus what we're talking about now with the union.
Yeah, and I also think that you lose the ability to say Rauner is involved in a war of words and throwing about a bunch of rhetoric if Karen Lewis is calling him a raving madman and talking about we're at war. So, you know, again, big surprise. Plenty of blame to go around It's 7:31. We go to a big story. And then I promise we're going to get to the presidential race and off to New Hampshire, because that's where the real fun is.
Oh,
those
yeah.
whack jobs that want to be president. There's a bunch of stuff this morning worthy of discussion.
Without a budget, and with courts ordering to make payments without a budget, we are just blowing through all the limits. We're adding to that debt, and then we pay fees and late fees on all that debt.
This is the Steve Cochran Show, live from the Allstate Showcase Studio on Chicago's very own.
You are listening to station WGN.
Basically, Springfield is the 16-year-old in your house that insists he won't wreck the car and promises he won't have a party. Just ridiculous. Let's move on for a moment. Eric Edelstein and Pat Brady are with us, as is Rick Pearson. Sunday Spin. Oh, my fault. I lost Eric. Would you get him back for us? Sunday Spin this weekend again. The guests are?
I've got David Yepsen, former national political columnist for the Des Moines Register, now at the Paul Simon Institute. And I've got Matt Strawn, former Iowa Republican chairman.
Pat Brady, you were with us in Iowa. We've had a couple of days to digest and now move on to New Hampshire, where Andrea will be this weekend into next week, reporting live for us. What are you making of Donald Trump spouting off again? And has he got any sort of case in Iowa against Ted Cruz?
You know, as I mentioned the other day, I attended his concession speech. I got myself a big frosty beer, and I was sitting in the back waiting for him to blow up, and he didn't. But he did the next day. He's absolutely lost his mind, claiming that the votes were fraudulent and that there needed to be a recount. And the upside for people that care about the party, it looks like Trump has no ground game in New Hampshire, and the polls are consistently wrong. So maybe there's a chance that somebody like Marco Rubio could actually win in New Hampshire.
And the Ted Cruz argument, Rick Pearson, that he's making is?
Well, one of the things, there's a number of things. One was allegedly Cruz supporters in the caucuses were telling Carson supporters that Ben Carson was dropping out.
So vote for Ted.
There were also the mailers that were sent out by the Cruz campaign to voters that assigned that looked very official and said voting violation. And it listed names of people and their neighbors, and as well as their voting record, which is public record. But it made it look like it was some kind of official declaration, and that received some scorn. But despite all this, if you were in these caucuses, and for example, Ben Carson's not happy about what happened, but if you're in those caucuses, you ostensibly have a representative there that speaks to the caucus. And so if Cruz's people are saying, well, he's dropping out or whatever, there would be a Cruz person in that caucus or a Carson person in that caucus to say,
no,
that's not true.
Didn't all that stuff you just laid out there, like maybe it's where we're from, but it didn't seem to offend any of our sensibilities when we were.
No, I absolutely.
Yeah, just go another day. The Iowa Attorney General apparently has certified the election results, so Trump doesn't have a case anyway. Either way.
Well, the Democratic Party, I don't know that it's a party function. It's not a state function. But certainly
the state has to certify the results.
No, they don't.
Oh, they don't?
No.
Why did the Attorney General put out a press release saying that they had certified the results? Who cares then?
I don't know why the Attorney General would, because it's not the Iowa
and
caucuses are a party function.
Trust the people of Iowa. Let me go to Eric Edelstein here. The town hall last night on CNN with Hillary and also the great Bernie Sanders, the great enigma that is Bernie Sanders. Did you get a chance to see it?
I did. I thought they both actually did pretty well. Those are good formats, I think, better than these debates, which are sort of just a bunch of stage pageantry and one-liners. I think you actually get some substance and some detail. I thought they both were really good. And, I think, as we've talked about even before Iowa, he's a real candidacy, and he's raising real money from grassroots. The question becomes, as we move into these bigger states that have more diverse populations, how will he do? I don't think there's any question he'll do well in New Hampshire. He's basically a favorite son there. The question becomes when the circus moves to Nevada and South Carolina and then some of those Super Tuesday states, how does he hold up? And, I think that's the million-dollar question.
The money that's coming in is surprising to me as it continues, because what we visibly saw in Iowa were tons of kids, really enthusiastic kids, and you had to feel good about the fact that kids were involved in the process again, even though they don't have a clue what they're talking about. But tons of kids were involved and a lot of excitement there. But those can't be the sum total of the Bernie donations that are coming in. So I'm wondering if the crowds look different in New Hampshire for Sanders.
Well, there's no question there's a large feeling, and I think we've seen it and talked about it with the Trump phenomenon and the Sanders phenomenon. You know, surprisingly, they are similar in some ways, in a kind of angst against the system, anger at institutions, displeasure with Washington. They just manifest in different ways. So there's an energy there, and I think it's demonstrated in some of the grassroots money. I don't think that's a new phenomenon in American politics. We certainly had that over time. The question is, how sustainable is it? I think the biggest concern for the Clinton campaign is that money prowess. I think that Sanders raised over $30 million in the fourth quarter. He raised $1 million, supposedly, just after he gave his speech in Iowa. So what that says to you is he's not going away anytime soon. The question is that a good thing? I mean, there's a strain of thought that Secretary Clinton does better when she's pushed and has competition. And so, you know, I don't know that a long Democratic nominating process is necessarily a bad thing. I don't think it's what the Clinton campaign hoped for or wanted. I still think she's the overwhelming favorite to be the nominee.
Eric Edelstein at Edel64, at ADEL64, Pat Brady at Pat_Brady, and Rick Pearson, Chicago Tribune. ChicagoTribune.com. What are you writing about today?
Well, we're going to take a recap at some of our polling that we've been doing this week, and moving forward with that, we also have the candidates for Cook County State's Attorney are at the Tribune editorial board for a debate there.
Well, that'll be a good time. Thank you, my friend.
Thank you.
Coming up, New Hampshire, former Governor of New Hampshire, John Sununu, former Bush 1 White House key player, and a guy who's got a lot of opinions about his home state, and is about to meet the love of his life, Andrea Darlis. When we come back, first it's traffic on 720 WGN. Keyman in Washington and Keyman in the Granite State. Former New Hampshire Governor John Sununu joins us. Good morning, Governor.
How are you, Steve?
It's been a long time. Nice to talk to you again.
It's good to be back on. Thank you for having me.
And say hello to Andrea Darlis, who will be in your state this weekend. You're going to love her.
Hi, Governor.
How are you, Andrea?
Nice to meet you. Thank you. I can't wait to meet you in person.
Governor, is this a time where you look forward to everyone getting the hell out, or you're glad they're there?
Yes.
All of the above.
This has been a circus like none other. Can you compare this to any other election?
No, and it's even more different than you might even realize. I have never seen an electorate as hard to read as this one, Steve. It is usually a volatile electorate here. In other words, our folks quite often don't make up their mind. A lot of our folks don't make up their mind until the last 2 weeks. I actually think we've got maybe 40-50%, it's my guess, going into this weekend with a lot of volatility in who they might vote for. I think a lot of folks here usually vote on substance. This is a pretty astute voting population, and they're usually very good at sorting out who's really in favor of what, and they vote on issues. But this year, I think there's a large component of style and bluster that has been part of the equation. And after Iowa, I think there's a third piece, and I think people are now beginning to think strategically. As I go out and about, supermarket, drugstore, coffee, I talk to people, and some folks are indicating they might be willing to vote for their second or third choice if it gives the country a good president, it gives the Republican Party a good nominee that can beat Hillary Clinton. And so post-Iowa, people are playing a little bit more voting chess, if you will, than they have in the past, and I think they're really going to wait until the last minute.
Governor, you've been a part of this a long time. It seems to me that there's even more excitement this time around. It just continues to evolve. Why do you think that is? More people are just involved with this process, or is it
or are
this
more
particular
people angry?
One? Yeah.
I think the country is scared to death. I think the country has seen 7 miserable years, and folks that really want this country to reestablish itself, if you will, as a leader internationally, and really get scared to death when they see we're approaching $20 trillion in debt. I think there's a sense that this is a last chance. It may not be a last chance, but there's that kind of a sense in the game. And they want to be part of fixing it, and they're trying to figure out how to do it. And so there's a lot more, at least verbal participation. I'm hoping it turns out to be ballot participation.
When you look at your fellow governors that are in the race, and the ones that are still viable, right. Christie and Kasich and Jeb Bush, any one of those are qualified on most levels to take the job. And theoretically make the country better, hopefully find a way to work with the other party and realize you're president of the United States, you're not president of one party or the other. Yet all of them struggling to get any attention at all. Why is it all about the show as opposed to actually hearing about people who could do the job?
Because it's been about the show. And unfortunately, the show and the media cooperating with the show, the mouth that roared, is just overwhelmed a lot of the rational aspects of politics. And you're right, the three governors, Bush, Christie, Kasich, and Rubio as a senator. Rubio was a Speaker of the House down in Florida. They know how to herd the cats of a legislature and how to get some things done. And frankly, I haven't endorsed anyone, but I've been pretty open about the fact that I can live with any one of those four as our nominee. In fact, I'd be thrilled if any one of those four becomes the Republican nominee, because I think they will beat Hillary Clinton. And that's what people should be looking at. The Cruz-Trump pairing that seems to be very popular because they're loud and angry, I think have absolutely no idea how to make the system function and have no idea what they're getting into. How can you take Ted Cruz? How can you serve in the Senate and be hated by every one of your Republican colleagues and think that you know how to make anything function? And Trump is got a long history of his bankruptcies. He banked, and not only the 4 hotel bankruptcies everybody knows, but Trump Airline went bankrupt.
Sure.
Trump Mortgage went bankrupt. Three Trump books went bankrupt. Trump Vodka's out of business.
It's all show.
Trump Steaks. The whole thing. This is a guy whose life has been a series of failures. Yeah, he might make a little bit of money here and there, but I don't want a guy who's statistically a crapshooter on every decision. And a guy that doesn't understand the nuclear triad is such a key part of our defense. You can't have anyone. And now he's delusional. He's down in Arkansas saying that he really won Iowa. You can't have somebody like that in the White House, and it's time people understood that.
And the majority of the statements that come out of Donald Trump's mouth are about Donald Trump. They're not about the people he claims to want to represent. So the people of New Hampshire's
he
BS meter.
You cannot go 20 words without saying I.
Exactly.
Really.
There's
an exercise for people that listen to him.
Yeah.
See if you can count 20 words without him saying I.
No, it won't happen. As a matter of fact, several narcissists called and go, good God, Donald, give it a rest. The BS meter of the people of New Hampshire is pretty good. Do you have confidence that they will see through that in the vote next Tuesday?
You know, I usually have extreme confidence. I am a little bit nervous about, as you pointed out, the character of this race is so different and so strange. I cannot connect what I run into as I talk to people out in the towns and cities and what the polls are saying. And when I see such a big disconnect between what I'm running into and what the polls are saying, I'm saying, what am I missing? And that's what I'm afraid of, Steve. I don't know what I'm missing right now.
Yeah, it's bizarre.
And it really is. And you know, You get on the phone with some of your old colleagues, old governors, old senators from up here who know the state pretty well, and the first thing we all say is, we don't know what's going on this time.
It's just it's beyond bizarre. And you got to laugh or you'd cry because it's so upside down and so ridiculous.
And, you know, it's usually embarrassing to go on radio and say, I don't know what's going on. But I'm trying to convey to people how strange this race is and how important it is to get back to looking at substance. You pointed out there are three governors running and a senator running that have been involved in making legislation for a long, long time. And you know, I know people may be shocked to hear this, but if you look at just records, the most conservative guy in the race is Jeb Bush.
Yeah, it's a true story.
And yet he's being tarred and feathered as a liberal. I'm not endorsing anyone, but I'm just saying in terms of perception, this is the strangest race in the world.
And honestly, because Trump is a human bug light and has created the ratings that he's created, the national news networks are tripping over each other to do the next exclusive sit down with a hairpiece, and that's made the problem exponentially worse. All right, so when our friend Andrea gets there to be live and cover the primary for us, what's the first place she ought to go see? Give her your recommendation.
Where is she setting up?
I'm going to be in the downtown area.
Yeah, you should be in the Capitol.
Manchester?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
Yep.
Look, just set up and they'll come to you.
I'll say Sununu sent me.
Well, I know she looks forward to meeting you, and I'm really glad that you took the time to talk to us. Hold on 1 second. That's Governor John Sununu.
We'll see you out there, Governor.
Former White House Chief of Staff as well, and for Bush 1, and a funny guy.
I was taking notes. My favorite Sununu quote today, he can't go 20 words without saying I.
Yeah. Yeah. I just wish he had an opinion. He's 5'4" or 5 or 6 inches of funny, really.
We'll try and get him on the program on Monday or Tuesday.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Yeah.
8 o'clock, we'll come back, do the news next on 720 WGN.
This is the Steve Cochran Show, live from the Allstate Showcase Studio on Chicago's very own
720 WGN.
912. It's interesting when you juxtapose the state of Indiana's government versus the state of Illinois. And one of the absolute architects, if not the architect, whether he takes credit for it or not, is Eric Holcomb of Mitch Daniels' very successful run before he decided not to run for the presidency and went off to run Purdue. Eric Holcomb would now like to be the next senator from the state of Indiana and joins us now on the phone. Nice to have you on the show. I know we've been trying to find a date that works. I'm glad this call worked out.
Yeah, thanks, Steve. Good morning to you and all the listeners.
And as you know, WGN blasts all the way through Indiana, so you're talking to a lot of Hoosiers this morning, and I'm sure they're glad to hear from you as well. So let me first say, thanks for your service. How many years in the Navy?
6 years, just over 6 years. Yep, right before Desert Storm is when I signed up. Came home and informed my parents that I had joined the Navy. Not that I was thinking about it, that it was a done deal, and I had a date to ship out. Actually went up and did push-ups in the snow for a couple months at Great Lakes.
Yeah, not far from here, obviously. Well, you know, again, we thank you for your service and we appreciate that commitment. You know, I look at Indiana, and you'll understand this, Eric, because you've lived in government business for a long time. We're in such a mess in Illinois. We're in such a mess in Chicago. And I love this city and I love this state. But it seems like you guys are doing a lot of things better there. And if you're going to run for the Senate, I guess I'd ask you to identify a few things that need to be fixed in Indiana, because from my view, things are going pretty well.
Well, they are. We're a state that literally works, and we've become kind of we've gone from a flyover state, you know, a little over a decade ago, to now really a global jobs magnet. And it's not rocket science. It's not complicated. It's just some fundamental approaches and practices that you have to be disciplined to follow through on. And that's, you know, not spending money you don't have and living within your means and creating an environment where people feel good about their investments. And that all has the ramifications of that is all good. And it means a better quality of life. And when you see our different regions, including the Northwest region, that is a real engine to our state economy. When you start to see that cooperation occur and people understand that as a state, we're all in this together, we're all going in the same direction, we start to, you know, click on all cylinders and it's full throttle, wide open, here we go, get on. And that train's, you know, if it's going in the wrong direction, it's hard to turn around. But if it's going in the right direction, It's full steam ahead, and that's kind of the path that we're on. But we've remained true to those principles of limited government. When Mitch Daniels, you referred to him, when we came in and left, it was night and day. And so our state government employee levels was down to the 1972 level when Mitch Daniels left office. So we limited our government. People didn't miss that. We improved the services at the very same time, proving more government does not equate to better government. In fact, it typically leads to worse government, bigger bureaucracy. So we right-sized our government force, and then we encouraged private sector solutions to a lot of the problems that were ailing us in the beginning, in those beginning years. And it just over time paid off. It wasn't all easy. It wasn't all popular, or the medicine didn't taste good going down, but it sure made us better. And that's why we are kind of this lighthouse or this beacon in the Midwest, where people say, we want to go there and we want to do business.
Eric Holcomb at Holcomb for Indiana is the website that you guys want to send people to. Is that right?
That's correct.
All right. So when
Indiana.com.
So when you go to Washington, you meet people around Indiana and they say, look, Eric, I know y'all like you, and I'm going to let you shoot hoops here in a second. But before we do that, if I send you to Washington with my vote, how are you going to get along with folks and get stuff done? Because, as you know, one of the biggest problems in D.C. is that everybody's more in it to be right. They're not there to do the right thing.
Yeah. Well, and that's certainly, you know, I've been on, as you may know, Steve, I've been on the road since the end of March, in kind of perpetual motion, and last year went to all 92 counties, put 25,000 miles on the car. Last year, the Earth's circumference is 24,901 miles, so I literally drove around the world.
That's a lot of Indiana.
That's a lot of Indiana and a lot of tenderloins, and I loved every day of it. Very encouraging, but I'll tell you that, folks, I've watched the electorate's mood, so to speak, go from worry to concern to anger to flat out now people are scared about the future of our country. And elections have consequences at the local level, at the state level, and certainly at the federal level. And while we have our house in order here in the state of Indiana, Washington, D.C. is just the opposite. And, you know, I can cite all the examples about our kind of national security concerns, our economic security concerns, our personal liberties and freedoms that are being infringed upon every day, intruded on.
But if you come in as a freshman senator, you're going to be a guy that's going to have to go literally door to door in the Senate building and go, look, I'm here to get along and I'm here to get something done. And we're not always going to agree, but let's figure out a way to talk. Is that your method?
That is the method, and that is what has proven to work here. I mean, part of the reason why I'm traveling all around the state, not just shooting hoops and making them, by the way, but part of the reason is because I want to best reflect and represent Indiana. And the way you do that is by showing up in person. That stuff money can't buy. Those are forged relationships that are deep and long. And so understanding the folks that are moving their communities and the issues that they face is of paramount importance here and in Washington, D.C., where you're representing that those interests, those local interests. And secondly, what has to occur out there and what occurred here in Indiana going back to 2005 is we said, here is our plan. If you elect me, this is what I will go fight for every single minute of every single day. And that's what got us back on track. If we had no plan, if we were just playing defense, if we were just kicking a can down the road, the can here in the state of Indiana would look like our national can. It's getting too big to kick. It's going to break our foot.
Yeah, and you don't
break our bank accounts.
And that's going to hurt your hoops situation. If you go to Holcomb for Indiana, by the way, you'll see pictures of Eric Holcomb shooting hoops in all of the stops and all of the counties. Before I let you go, your opponent is Congressman Todd Young, and this is a tough choice for the people of Indiana because he's a popular guy as well. What's one distinct difference between the two of you?
Well, I'd say I have actually two opponents, two congressmen. Congressman Todd Young and Congressman Marlon Stutzman, both are friends. So that makes it better. But what's different is our kind of life experience and our life story. I served in the Navy, and I've spent my entire adult life post-Navy service here in the state of Indiana, turning this state around with real results to point to, helping take a state from $800 million in debt to a $2 billion surplus, helping take a state that needed to address our roads and bridges and found a way creatively to pay for them, not on the taxpayers' backs. We actually paid for all the record-building decade of road and bridge building with private sector dollars. I was part of all that. So mm-hmm. I have kind of real results, and I've not been in Washington, D.C., which turns out, you know, they used to say the power of incumbency was a huge advantage. And in the day that I live in today and the doors that I'm knocking on every single day, that's not an advantage anymore. So
no, incumbency is kind of like dirty underwear now. If you've been there and done that, people go, well, next. So that's...
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the bottom line is people say, look, the next 6 years, a United States Senate term, the next 6 years can't look like the last 6 years. So just like in 2005, if you want to change the results, sometimes you got to change the lineup. And I've got real experience that led to real results, that led to a real improvement of quality of life. And that's what I go. I go out and I don't run down anybody else, my opponents included. I talk about my experience and what that can lead to in Washington, D.C. And I'm encouraged by the support that we're getting every single day. I mean, we've got up in the region, you know, we've got mayor of Valparaiso, the mayor of Portage, the mayor of LaPorte, sure. All supporting me.
Right in our backyard. Meanwhile, all those people are looking at Springfield in Indiana, and they're just giggling. They're just looking at Springfield, giggling, going, what are you people doing? One last thing before I let you fly. And again, it's holcombforindiana.com. And I'm sure we'll talk again. And good luck with the run here. But, you know, in helping build Mitch Daniels and being the architect, my word, not yours, of his very successful run and his governorship, I was really disappointed in 2012 when he decided not to run. He's entitled to have his life, and I'm sure he enjoyed going off to run Purdue. But do you think there's any chance that he may, you know, jump back in? He hasn't closed the door completely on a national run at some point, has he?
Well, I mean, I think he is enjoying life right now. He's the, you know, I wanted him also to be the president of the United States of America, not the president of Purdue, but Purdue was the winner in that deal.
Mm-hmm.
He would have served this country well, and he would have taken exactly what I want to do. He would have taken the same approaches that he led the effort to turn this state around, had a lot of people helping. We the people all coalesced and came, rallied around this platform that he promoted. And led, he would have done that for the country. But, you know, he just signed an extension at Purdue University, which is just a, you know, state-of-the-art, world-class university here, and he's really enjoying his time there. So you never know. Never say never, I guess. But right now I know he's doing a lot of good for a lot of students that are going through Purdue University's programs. And we're lucky. Hoosiers are lucky that Mitch Daniels stayed in Indiana.
Good luck to your opponents, and certainly good luck to you. I appreciate your time, and I look forward to talking to you again. And I like your jump shot. You got a good vertical here. You got good extension. I don't think I've got a shot.
Follow through.
Yeah, follow through is not bad. Always fingers at the basket. Hold on for us. Holcombforindiana.com. That's the website. And again, you know what they're doing? You know, I mean, I'm actually jealous. Do you ever think you'd be in Illinois, in Chicago, and be jealous of Indiana? Well, I'm jealous of Indiana.
Jealous of their finances, maybe.
Jealous of the way the state's run.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable. Good for them. 924, back after this on 720 WGN.